We have begun our exposition of the Sermon on the Mount on Sunday afternoons with an introduction and then looking at the Beatitudes. And today we will move past the Beatitudes to a section called the Similitudes. And like the Beatitudes, they are called that because of a Latin word. And you can probably hear the English in there too. The Similitudes describe what Jesus' disciples are similar to. And so he uses a couple of familiar analogies to help us understand the impact that we are supposed to be making on the world. And we will be spending our time primarily in Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 through 16. So let's begin just by reading these verses. Directly after the Beatitudes, Jesus says, "You are the salt of the earth. But if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven." So in the Beatitudes, Jesus identifies who the citizens of the kingdom of heaven will be. The people who will be truly blessed will be the people who have the qualities that he describes there, because they will be the people who are the fertile ground. When the word is sown, they are the ones who will receive it and produce fruit. But as Jesus moves past the Beatitudes to this section that we might call the Similitudes, he's describing the impact of kingdom citizens on the world around them. And he does it using these two analogies of salt and light. But the second analogy is illustrated with two images, a city and then a lamp. And so Jesus is using some very familiar images, things that his audience would have been very familiar with. And they are simple images that are easy to understand. But I think the more that we appreciate them, the more we understand how profound they are because of what they call us to be and what Jesus says about our purpose. And so the first thing to understand is that Jesus is saying that there must be something noticeably distinct about us. If you've ever had underflavored food and then put a little bit of salt on it, you know what a difference that can make. Because the salt is very distinct from the food that you put it on. If you've ever been in a very dark room and suddenly seen a light come on, then you know what a difference that makes. Because the light is so different from the darkness. And so there is a tremendous difference between plain mashed potatoes and salted mashed potatoes, right? There's a tremendous difference between being in a dark cave with no light and lighting a match. It makes an enormous difference. The introduction of salt and light change the whole picture, and they do that because they are distinct. But the second thing that I think we ought to notice about this right away, just as an overview, is what these analogies imply about the world. And we'll talk more about these in a moment, but salt has two primary purposes. That is to preserve and to flavor. And light also has two primary purposes, which is to reveal and to guide. And so if Jesus is saying that we are to be the salt of the earth and the light of the world, that implies that we live in a world that is rotting and decaying. It's dark. And I don't think you have to be a religious person to be able to understand that. Anybody who turns on the news, anybody who talks to their friends at work, anybody who just opens their eyes and looks around, can see the darkness and decay in this place. All around us, there are terrible injustices. There's violence. There's oppression. There are bad people doing bad things to people. It's a bad place to be sometimes. We live in a world that's full of problems. There's broken relationships. There are broken people. Darkness and decay is all around. And like I said, there's nothing particularly shocking about that. I think most people who are realists can see that right away. But what is shocking is what Jesus claims to be the solution. You realize Jesus did not preach this sermon to the high and mighty of the world. He wasn't preaching to the religious elite. He wasn't preaching to the financial elite. He wasn't preaching to kings and rulers, people of high academic standing or anything like that. He was preaching to crowds of people that came out to hear him. Ordinary people, like me and you. And Jesus has the gall to look at them and say, "You are the ones who will change the world." That's amazing. He looks at them and says, "You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world." And the reason why Jesus could say that to these ordinary crowds of people was because they were the ones who came out to hear him preach. Jesus knew that his preaching, his message, would have an impact on people that would change the world around them. And the same is true today. We are the people that can change the world if we will listen to the words of Jesus. So what does he mean? How does that work? Well, let's work our way through these two analogies and try to unpack them a little bit. And we'll start with the first one. Jesus says, "You are the salt of the earth." Now, as I mentioned a moment ago, salt in the ancient world had two primary functions, to preserve and to flavor. I looked this up so I could be right about it. Refrigerators did not become common in the United States until about the 1930s or the 1940s. So some of you probably remember your parents talking about a time before refrigeration, if you weren't there yourself. But before refrigeration became common, salt was used as a preservative. Salt preserves food by reducing the amount of water available. And so that prevents microbes from growing, and it slows or stops spoilage. That's why country ham is so salty. If any of you like to have country ham for breakfast every now and then, it goes back to those days. It was when salt was cured in a salt, or when ham was cured in a salt box. And so the first thing that Jesus is saying is that the citizens of the kingdom of heaven will have a preservative effect. That some way they will stop the breakdown and the decay in the world around them. They'll work against it. But the second function of salt is to add flavor. And salt is the original spice. Even now, if you finish cooking dinner, or your wife or your husband finishes cooking dinner, and you think, this needs a little more flavor, salt is probably the first thing that you reach for. Salt enhances the flavor of food, and it does that by suppressing bitterness. And as the salt suppresses the taste of bitterness in your mouth, it allows other flavors to come out. Things like sweetness and savoriness. That's why I like to put salt on watermelon. That's probably the most southern thing about me. Put a little salt on watermelon, and all of a sudden it tastes really, really sweet. So try that sometime. And so what salt can do is it can make good food taste better. It can make unpalatable food palatable and enjoyable. And so the second thing that Jesus is saying is that kingdom citizens will work to make an unpalatable or unappealing world palatable and flavorful. We'll find ourselves in situations that are just not very good sometimes. But by our influence, we will be able to make it into something good. That's what Jesus is saying. Now, the second part of this analogy is where Jesus says in verse 14, "You are the light of the world." And as I said a moment ago, light has two primary functions. It reveals and it guides. And those two functions are very closely related. So if you are in a very dark room, you don't know where to go because you can't see the path. And so if you try to walk, you'll probably end up causing yourself some pain. And that's a pretty good metaphor for the way most people in the world try to live. Several times the Bible talks about those who are in darkness, those who walk in darkness. And the idea is that if you walk in darkness, it won't be very pleasant. You know, you'll keep jamming your toe into things and bumping your shins on stuff, and it'll hurt. And if you're in the dark, you don't know exactly why. You just keep bumping into stuff. And there's a lot of people who live their lives that way. It's a dark world where people will stumble around. But the citizens of the kingdom of heaven will work to change that. They will bring light into the darkness. They will reveal the path. They will become a guide to others and keep them from stumbling. And you might notice that Jesus takes the second analogy and he uses two illustrations. The first is a city set on a hill, which he says cannot be hidden. And so just imagine that. If there was a city that was on the top of a hill, that would mean that that city is visible from every angle. You know, if it was on the side of a hill or if it was down in the valley, you might have to be in the exact right perspective to see it. But if it's up on top of a hill, you could see it from 360 degrees around, almost like a lighthouse or something. And so I think the idea here is that travelers in the darkness would be drawn to it. No matter where they're coming from, they would see the light of the city, and they would know that that's the place to go. There's rest and there's relief there. It's also very reminiscent of what we talked about in the first lesson from Isaiah chapter 2. If you remember, we talked in the first lesson about the mountain and the symbolism of the mountain. In Isaiah 2, it talks about the mountain of the house of the Lord. And it was pictured there as being established as the highest of the mountains, lifted up above the hills, and all the nations flow to it. And there are many people coming from all over, and they're saying, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the house of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths." And so there is that picture of people being drawn from all over, coming together, being attracted to the brightness of this thing. And so Jesus says, kingdom citizens will become a beacon of hope to the world around us. But the second illustration that Jesus uses here is a lamp on a lampstand. And notice how this one emphasizes some intentionality. The first thing he says about the city is that the city set on a hill cannot be hidden. It's impossible to hide it. There's no way to cover that up. And in some ways, that will be true of us. That there is no way for us not to stand out from the world that we live in. But the second thing is that we have to be intentional about it. Because a lamp could be hidden. If you put a basket over it, like Jesus talks about, it would block the lights and it wouldn't do any good. And so the only way that a lamp does any good for anybody is if it's intentionally placed where it can shine and any obstructions are removed. And so Jesus is giving some instructions to us here, saying that we need to let our light shine in verse 16. And so he says, in the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. And that requires some cooperation. You know, we sang some of these ideas in the songs just a few moments ago. We sing these songs with our kids from a very young age. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. Don't let Satan put a bushel over it. You know, we sing these ideas to remind each other that we are supposed to be different. We are supposed to be a visible example to the world. But what Jesus is saying is that we will be the people that we ought to be when we live the way that we ought to live. We'll function the way that we ought to function when we become what we're supposed to become. And so notice that there is this application in verse 16 where he says, let your light shine before others. We shouldn't be trying to cover it up. We shouldn't be obstructing the image of the brightness. But in verse 13 and in verse 14, he doesn't say you must become the salt of the earth or that you must become the light of the world. He says that's what you are. Because by the very virtue of being who Jesus wants us to be, we will have the impact on the world that he wants us to have. When your life is characterized by good works, then your light will shine before others and make an impact on them. And that really brings us back to the initial observation that we made. Jesus is saying that there must be something noticeably distinct about us. Salt and light make a difference in the decay and the darkness because they introduce something new, something different that wasn't there before. And I want you to think about what he says here at the end of verse 13. He says, if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. Okay, how many times has that happened to you? That you've been trying to make a recipe and you go to your pantry and you pull your salt out and you say, oh man, salt's gone bad. It's lost its taste. That doesn't actually happen. I mean, we have lots of stuff that go bad in our house sometimes. You know, you start having a weird smell coming out of the fridge, and then you have the fun game of figuring out which container it's coming from. But thankfully, salt doesn't go bad. Salt doesn't have an expiration date. Salt doesn't lose its taste. And so that's a little bit puzzling that Jesus talks about salt losing its flavor. Chemically, salt is sodium chloride. It's a stable compound. It just is what it is. However, salt can become mixed with impurities. And apparently that was more common in these days than it is in ours. They didn't buy their salt at Kroger. And so, you know, they had salt that was mixed with impurities. And over time, if it was in a humid environment, what you could actually have happen is that the salt would leach out, leaving only the impurities. And so what you thought was a little bowl of salt might actually end up becoming just a bowl of flavorless dust. And I think when you start to think about that, that it starts to make a powerful point. That in order for us to be the salt of the earth, we've got to keep the earth out of the salt. In order for us to be able to make an impact on the world around us, we have to be distinct from the world. If we let the impurities in, then we become the impurities. If we let the world in, we're no different than the world, and so we can't make an impact on the world. And so Jesus is talking about people who are distinct from the world. They're totally different. They're not like the world. And so in order to be the salt of the earth, we have to keep the earth out of the salt. And when we are what we ought to be, we'll work to preserve what's good in a rotting world. We'll work to bring out the pleasant flavors of life by suppressing the bitterness. We'll work to illuminate the path and guide others. And the way that we do that is by bringing attention to our Father who is in heaven. You know what else is true about salt and light? Salt and light don't bring attention to themselves. They always bring attention to something else. You know, when you go over to somebody's house, if they've fixed you a meal, you don't eat the food and say, man, that is some good salt. If you stand on a hillside and you look at a city, you don't look at the city and say, man, those are some high-quality lights. No, the salt brings attention to the food. The light brings attention to what it illuminates. It's not the thing that gets the attention. It's the thing that brings attention to something else. And so when we function as salt and light, others will see our good works and give glory to our Father who's in heaven. And you know what's really interesting about this statement in verse 14? As Jesus looks at this crowd of people on this Galilean hillside, and he says, "You are the light of the world." What's interesting about that is that later he'll make the same claim about himself. Especially in the Gospel of John, he says this a couple of times, "I am the light of the world." Isn't that interesting? Jesus is the true light, but his disciples begin to resemble him. Jesus is the source of light, but the ones who listen to his teaching reflect his light. Jesus is the one who brings light into the world, but as we follow him, we show others his light in us. And so he is the true light, but we reflect him. And I think that that helps to explain how these lofty goals can belong to lowly people like us. How can a group of ordinary people like me and you change the world? Well, the answer is by being changed to become like Jesus. As we come to reflect his nature, we lead people to him. He is the true light, but we reflect his nature. He's the bread of life, but we come to be the salt that brings out his flavor. And as we do so, our influence leads people to him. And as we are changed to become like him, he's the one who gets the glory because people see him in us and they're ultimately drawn to him. And these are themes that are echoed throughout the New Testament. I've just picked out a couple of verses that draw on this same kind of imagery. Verses that are familiar to us. Philippians chapter 2, verses 14 and 15. Paul writes to the Christians there, and he says, "Do all things without grumbling or disputing, that you may be blameless and innocent, children of God, without blemish, in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world." You want to know how you can keep your relationships from breaking down and decaying? Do you want to know how to make the world a more pleasant place? Do you want to know how to illuminate the path and show people how they ought to live? Start with verse 14. Do all things without grumbling or complaining. That's a part of the decay that we see around us. That's a part of the breakdown that's happening. Grumbling and disputing is a good way to foster bitterness and division, but people who leave those worldly ways behind begin to act as salt and as light. What about in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 5 through 7? Here Paul writes, "For what we proclaim is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, with ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. For God, who said, 'Let light shine out of darkness,' has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us." You see what Paul's saying there? He's saying, the same God who spoke light into the universe on day one of creation is the God who is bringing light into our hearts. The God who's able to bring light into the darkness, hope into hopelessness, joy into joylessness. That's the God who sustains us. And he does that so that we can reflect that message to the people in our lives. we can let that same light radiate out of us. And so Jesus lives in us so that we can show others the power belongs to him. But it's not only the New Testament that talks like this. This isn't only New Testament imagery. In fact, I want to show you where it was prophesied. And there's probably more than one place we could look. But consider Isaiah chapter 60. This is the scripture reading that we had at the beginning. In Isaiah 60, in verse 1, it says, "Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord has risen upon you. For behold, darkness shall cover the earth, and thick darkness the peoples, but the Lord will arise upon you, and his glory will be seen upon you. And nations shall come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your rising." Have you ever wondered where the phrase "rise and shine" comes from? Here it is, Isaiah 60, verse 1. See, Isaiah was a prophet who looked forward to a time when things would begin to change on the earth. A time when it would be covered in darkness, thick darkness would cover the people. He saw a world where people were stumbling around with no direction, but then he saw some people who would begin to shine as lights in that darkness. People who would begin to reflect the light that had come into their lives, resulting in nations and kings being drawn to their brightness. And then in verse 19, he goes on to say, "The sun shall be no more your light by day, nor for brightness shall the moon give you light. But the Lord will be your everlasting light, and your God will be your glory. Your sun shall no more go down, nor your moon withdraw itself, for the Lord will be your everlasting light, and your days of mourning shall be ended." Now, these verses are actually referenced in Revelation chapter 21. But I think that when we see them there and here, we shouldn't simply think about the future. We should think about the relationship that we have with God now. That when God comes into our lives, when that light shines in the darkness of our hearts, the way that Paul talked about in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, we begin to show others that the surpassing power belongs to him and not to us. That we have joy that the world doesn't know. We have peace that transcends our circumstances. We can exist in whatever state we're in with contentment because we have a source of light that darkness cannot overcome. And so we can live in this everlasting light right now because the everlasting God is our glory. We can rise and shine, for our light has come. Now I want to show you what Isaiah does next. Look in Isaiah 61. Isaiah 61 in verse 1 goes on to say, "The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to those who are bound, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn, to grant to those who mourn in Zion, to give them a beautiful headdress instead of ashes, the oil of gladness instead of mourning, the garment of praise instead of a faint spirit, that they may be called oaks of righteousness, the planting of the Lord, that he may be glorified." Do you recognize that? This is a servant song from Isaiah that Jesus read from the scroll in Luke chapter 4. In Luke chapter 4, Jesus went into the synagogue in Nazareth. He read from this scroll, and when he finished reading, he rolled it up and he sat down and he said, "Today, this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." Jesus is the fulfillment of this. Jesus is the one who brings good news to the poor. He's the one who binds up the brokenhearted. He's the one who proclaims liberty to the captives. He's the one that turns our weeping into joy. He plants us in righteousness like oak trees. All of the darkness and decay that sin brought into our lives is reversed by the strength that we find in Him. And look at the results in verse 4. As it talks about people who are planted like oak trees in righteousness, it says, they shall build up the ancient ruins. They shall raise up the former devastations. They shall repair the ruined cities, the devastations of many generations. Do you see the imagery there? Jesus is saying that citizens of His kingdom, or Isaiah is seeing that citizens of the Savior's kingdom, will look around and see a world that's in shambles. They'll see destruction and devastation. They'll see ruin and decay. They'll see it on TV and talk radio. They'll see it at work. They'll see it in their friends. They'll see broken marriages all around them. They'll see all of this devastation, all of this ruin, and they will work to change it. By their impact, ruins can be rebuilt. Destruction can be reversed. Decay can be stopped. Kind of like salt. Just like salt stops the decay, citizens of this kingdom will repair and halt the destruction in the world. And so in Christ, our mission is to preserve and even repair the spiritual ruins around us. And so as we said, anyone who looks can see pain and suffering all around us. The effects of sin are palpable. We live in a world that is full of darkness and rottenness. So it's time that we act like salt and light. When normal everyday people like you and me listen to the teaching of Jesus, we have the power to change the world. That's what Jesus is telling us. We have the power to change the world around us. We have the power to make a difference in the people's lives that we come in contact with. One person at a time, one conversation at a time, one good deed at a time. The kingdom of heaven prevails in us and through us, and we overcome the world. We have the power to bring light and healing into a world that desperately needs it. And so as we become what our King wants us to become, we'll do what He wants us to do, and we'll have the effect that He wants us to have. Let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. That's the sermon this afternoon. If there's somebody here that realizes that you need the kind of hope, the kind of purpose that Jesus describes of kingdom citizens, and you are ready to make a commitment to take His mission on as your mission, you can act on that today before you leave. There's no rule saying we can only have one baptism a day. So if there's somebody this afternoon who wants to do what Elizabeth did this morning, you have the opportunity. And if there's somebody here with some other kind of spiritual need that we can help you with, you can let that be known as well. If we can help you in some way, come to the front while we stand and sing.